Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, bright colours, but without the pigments. How the wings of a butterfly could make your mobile phone much brighter than it was before. Also, how a piece of paper can tell a person's blood group in just seconds, and why it's also time to wind your watches back 4.5 billion years.
The current theories of the solar system's formation say that when Earth was formed, it was too hot to have any water on it. The water must have arrived after the planet had cooled. Proposed sources of that are big icy things like comets, but if you look at the hydrogen-deuterium isotope ratio in comets, it doesn't match up with the hydrogen-deuterium isotope ratio of the water on Earth, so there must be some other sources to account for that difference.
Phil Broadwith has the solution to that watery mystery in the form of a frosty asteroid. And it's on its way. That's the answer, not the asteroid. Hello, I'm Chris Smith. And also in this, the June edition of the Chemistry World Podcast, are Mike Brown, Phil Broadwith and Bibiana Kempiseo.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First up this month, the chemical makeup of a dinosaur. Mike.
So a collaboration of scientists from Stanford University, the University of Pennsylvania and the University of Manchester in the UK have been studying Archaeopteryx, which is a dinosaur specimen that is basically the link between birds and the dinosaur. So it's got bird character and dinosaur character, reptile character. And the team have been looking at the fossil specimen of Archaeopteryx using a technique called synchrotron rapid scanning X-ray fluorescence, which is a technique that identifies the chemical structure at very, very low concentrations.
So this is where you shine synchrotronic, in other words, X-ray type beams at a surface, and various atoms embedded in that surface then fluoresce or glow with light of very specific wavelength, which you can pick up, and that enables you to decode what chemicals are on that surface.
Yeah, that's right.
And how is this helpful to understanding what's going on in a fossil?
Until now, people have thought that fossils are just imprints of bones and the structure, in this instance, Archaeopteryx. But they've been looking very closely at the fossils and have found that, in actual fact, there's remnants of bone and protein tissue left. So they're not just imprints, they're actually tissue and structure. So what they've actually found is that there's traces of sulfur and phosphorus on the fossil.
Presumably the sulfur is coming from proteins and the phosphorus is going to be maybe bits of DNA, but probably bone.
Yeah, that's right. So sulfur is found in cysteine, which is in keratin, which is a tough fibrous structural protein in hair and nails. And in birds, it's found in the feather shards, the thick bit at the bottom. And what they found is that the sulfur concentration in Archaeopteryx is very, very similar, very good correlation to modern birds nowadays, like canaries and things like that. And the phosphorus that's present in the sample is also very, very similar to the concentrations of phosphorus in bone of modern birds as well. So there's this direct correlation between a dinosaur millions of years ago and modern birds, which is really exciting.
Which reinforces the notion that birds are the closest living relative dinosaurs have today. So what are they going to do now? They've got this interesting observation. Where are they going next with it?
The plan at the moment is to study other dinosaur fossils. So there are quite a few specimens of Archaeopteryx in Germany, and they're going to confirm their data by studying other specimens of the fossil. Then they're going to move on to other specimens of other fossils, other dinosaurs, to see whether we can find out whether there's any residual tissue or bone left in the fossils that they thought were imprints.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much, Mike. Let's go from something that we think was responsible for wiping out the dinosaurs, an asteroid, to present research on asteroids now. So tell us about asteroids and their sugary coating, let's say, Phil.
Well, Chris, this particular asteroid, 24 Themis, is in the main asteroid belt, and it's been found to have a very thin coating of ice all over the surface. It's not usual to find actual ice on these kind of objects. Normally water or ice would sublime at these sort of at the temperature and pressures on around these asteroids.
just orientate me in terms of the solar system and all that kind of thing. So where is this body and how big is it? Is it a big asteroid, is it?
Yeah, it's a really big asteroid. That's how we can sort of see it using these telescopes. We're actually talking about a family of asteroids. They're in the main asteroid belt, so between Jupiter and Mars. And what's been seen in other members of this family is that they have comet-like tails. So that kind of tells us that there's ice on them. But they're too small to study properly with the telescopes that we've got. So you've got to look at the Big Brother, if you like, which is several kilometres across, and see whether there's ice on that.
So how are they accounting for the fact that there is this sheen of ice around the outside of this big body? Is that ice coming from inside somehow and getting onto the surface?
So what these guys did is they took infrared spectra, they looked at... There's a particular absorption in the spectrum that indicates that there's water of some kind present. They've compared that spectrum with known hydrated minerals to see if the water is trapped within a mineral structure. It's not. And then they've used some spectral modelling to work out exactly what kind of ice they're looking at. Is it small bits or big bits? And what they've seen is it's this very thin coating of ice. So that's a bit of a conundrum. So what they're suggesting is that somehow ice that's subliming from a deeper store within the asteroid is then condensing on the outside because of the very large gravity of this thing. It's bigger than most, than a lot of other asteroids. The ice can't quite escape when it's subliming.
And because the asteroid belt is basically a planetary rubbish dump, it's material that would have formed a planet, didn't quite get there. It's the building blocks or rubble left over from the building of our solar system 4.5 billion years ago. Probably this is therefore really informative about the kind of stuff that went into forming planets and tells us a bit about where the water came from that we find on planets like Earth now.
Exactly that, Chris. The current theories of the solar system's formation say that when Earth was formed, it was too hot to have any water on it. It was a big ball of molten rock. The water must have arrived after the planet had cooled. Proposed sources of that are big icy things like comets. But if you look at the hydrogen-deuterium isotope ratio in comets, it doesn't match up with the hydrogen-deuterium isotope ratio of the water on Earth. So there must be some other sources to account for that difference.
So those asteroids could hold the key to the answer. Thank you, Phil. And incidentally, if you'd like to read a bit more about that asteroid work, which has been carried out by Humberto Campins, Andrew Rivkin and Joshua Emery, you can look up Phil's report, which is called Frosty Asteroid Surprises Astronomers, and it's on the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org. Now, many of you are probably acquainted with the adage that a butterfly flaps its wings in South America and it causes a hurricane somewhere else in the world. That's chaos theory. But I bet you haven't heard the version that ends in and creates a much better screen for your laptop.
My name is Mohan Srinivasarao. I am a professor at Georgia Institute of Technology. We're trying to understand what are all the different mechanisms that exist to produce a visual appearance. In other words, what is the color of the wings of a bird or wings of a butterfly and things of that sort? What are all the various ways you can produce color and how does nature get it done?
Because many people would believe, if you look at things around us in the real world, that most of those are pigments. That's not actually
correct.
True, is it?
There is a lot of pigmented colors, obviously. Lots of plants have pigmented colors, although there are a few exceptions where plant colors have structurally based colors. By that I mean some kind of a structure that interacts with light to produce the appearance that you happen to see. And so we are particularly interested in things in butterflies or beetles or birds that produce color not necessarily because of pigments but because of a variety of structural motifs that exist.
The wavelength of light being what it is, those structural colours must be being produced by arrangements of molecules down at nanometer scales. Do you think it's easy, first of all, to understand how this works, but B, also to copy it?
Copying, I think, is the easier part, because we don't have to arrange the molecules quite the same way as it is done on the wings of a butterfly. You just need a structure that mimics that. If I'm thinking about, say, a blue morpho...
This is a butterfly, isn't it?
This is a butterfly. The structural features that produce that color is absolutely fantastic on multiple length scales. However, in order for me to create a blue that looks more or less like a morpho butterfly blue, I don't exactly have to have the same architecture the butterfly created to produce that blue.
So if one looks at a blue morpho butterfly and you could zoom in on the wing surface, what's there to make the colour that we see?
The wings are essentially made up of chitin, and chitin is a complex biomolecule. However, what is more important for the production of the colour is there is a Christmas tree-like structure that is produced, and the spacing between certain shape of that Christmas tree-like object, that is on the order of the wavelength of light, now a little less than that. It's very intricate, and that is what allows the blue morpho to have the color it does. The beauty of the structural scales and the organization of chitin, what various structural elements there are, is just absolutely fantastic. The variety is just astounding. And I don't think we can, with all the photolithography advances, I do not believe that we can exactly make what the butterfly does.
So are people actually trying to copy this? And what do they have in mind doing? I mean, what could you do with an understanding of this technology?
Right. The idea is not to have any dyes and pigments. You know, in many cases, dyes have been associated with a variety of problems with disease in some cases. And so the attraction is to produce a color or produce an appearance of a particular color without having the pigments involved in it. The second thing is it possible that we could understand what is it that creates this beautiful structures on the wings, and can we replicate it on a very large length scale over centimeters, for example, or even several inches, if you will, without really having to have complex lithographic processes to do that. And so the question is it possible that somehow we could produce the color that we want by understanding how the butterflies do it, and can we do it rather in an elegant fashion, just as elegantly as the butterfly does?
With an eye on climate change, global warming, and making things more efficient, though, one thing that I've noticed is that many of these things like butterflies that do use structural color, they don't come equipped with their own light source, but they nonetheless look incredibly bright. So can we take something away from this in terms of how they do that, how they get so reflective, and use that to make much better or more efficient use of energy in the world around us?
I think that's entirely possible. And in fact, I think there was a company formed in Massachusetts a number of years ago, and I'm told that company has been bought out by Qualcomm for mobile phone displays. So, for example, right now your computer screens are all backlit, meaning there's a light behind your computer screen, and that takes away a lot of your energy. And your computer screen, of course, is particularly useless if you're sitting outside in the sun. But the butterflies, on the other hand, are fantastic. It is that attraction, I think, that led Qualcomm to buy this company out. And the idea was to create structures just like the butterfly does, and to be able to move those structures fairly quickly to produce various colors. Because after all, by moving those structures, I'm changing the periodic nature of the material, and that changes the reflectivity. And this would be a low power consuming but incredibly bright display.
How long do you think it'll be before we start to realize the potential of the things that you've been talking about?
Well, I think Qualcomm already has a display out on the market, although I haven't seen it. And I would suspect within the next 5 to 10 years, we will see these things out in the marketplace. I mean, there are already, Procter & Gamble has their toothpaste displays that have structural color in them. Other places, for example, currencies of certain countries have an interference security device. So we will see them increasingly, I think.
So someday soon, you'll finally be able to see what's actually on the screen of your mobile phone on a sunny day. That was structural colourist Mohan Srinivasarao, and he's based at Georgia Tech in the US. This is Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how a piece of paper can tell a person's blood group. But first, Bibi, researchers in Canada and the US are flexing their artificial muscles this month. Tell us about this.
A lot of research has gone into developing synthetic elastomers that mimic the elastic properties of muscle tissue for use in biomedical applications. But there are several limitations associated with this. The very first one is that very often these materials they're not identified by the immune system of the host's body and therefore are attacked and rejected. And the other one is that these systems, these materials, cannot help with tissue repair or regeneration. Therefore, trying to synthesize or trying to prepare artificial muscle tissue using proteins is an alternative that seems to have some basis.
How are researchers trying to pursue that?
Researchers at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver in Canada, together with co-workers at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University in the US, are working to try to replicate the properties of titin, which is a muscle protein. It actually is very interesting because it's the largest single polypeptide in nature and is responsible for the passive elastic properties of muscle.
It's one of the structural proteins, isn't it? It helps the muscle to arrange where it puts the other fibres like the actin and the myosin that do the contraction. So how have they actually built this protein then?
They've engineered biomaterials that consist of globular proteins. They are the molecular springs, and they are derived from Streptococcus bacteria, together with amino acid sequences derived from resilin, which is an elastomeric protein. They have used genetically modified Escherichia coli bacteria to express these proteins, and then they used a photochemical reaction to cross-link them. And this resulted in a gel-like material that has the desired properties, which are the toughness and the elasticity of the natural muscle proteins.
Have they actually demonstrated it can be used yet, though, or is this just at the experimental stage?
It is at the experimental stage, and they're hoping to use it in tissue engineering as scaffold and matrix for artificial muscles.
Well, terrific news, and we hope it won't be too long, because obviously muscles and rebuilding them is important, especially, I suppose, we could possibly try that for micro-machines and things as well. Well, look, here's something that probably will have a tangible use much sooner and is probably closer to being realised. It may even be in use right now, Mike. Tell us about this new way of using a piece of paper to work out what blood group someone is.
Well, researchers at Monash University in Australia have devised a cheap paper test to quickly identify your blood type.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Obviously, identifying what blood group someone is very important, so we give the recipient the right blood so they don't have a transfusion reaction. But how does this work?
Well, researchers have taken a piece of paper and they've put a microfluidic circuit on it containing antibodies at different parts of the circuit, antigens, which are chemical markers on the surface of the red blood cells, will interact with the antibodies, different antibodies. So depending on where you put the blood on the circuit, the blood will either spread out because it's not reacting with an antibody, or it will agglutinate because it is reacting. So you've got a very visual representation as to which antibodies are affecting your blood, and therefore you can work out which blood type you are.
And it does all the blood groups. What about rhesus, the D, as well? Because that's important with childbirth and things. Does it do that one too?
Yes, it does. Yeah. It's got a separate section with the antibody for rhesus as well.
And who is this useful for? Because obviously we're well acquainted with having very well-developed blood services in countries like this one, where this may be less useful because we already know how to do this very, very well. We have machines that do it for us. So where are they targeting this at?
The researchers hope that the piece of paper, the test, will be very useful for third world countries where you don't need specifically someone trained or a doctor or a nurse to do the procedure. You basically take a blood sample and you spot it on the different sections of the paper. So you can have an unskilled person doing it in the third world where they don't have electricity and they don't have access to other ways of testing blood.
And more importantly, what does it cost?
It's very, very cheap. In theory, you can just send hundreds of thousands of these out, and basically they'll be equipped with these tests so they can find out very, very quickly who's what blood type someone is and therefore give them the right blood to help save their life.
Sounds like a fantastic breakthrough and one that could make a massive impact, especially in developing countries. Thank you, Mike. Well, on the subject of developing countries, many of them have a serious problem with malaria. In fact, there are up to 500 million cases of malaria every year, 3 million of them fatal, and the majority of those fatalities happening in children. The problem is made worse by the fact that the malaria parasite has become resistant to many of the standard drugs that are normally used to treat and prevent the disease. But there is one drug that's showing considerable promise. Diana Bowles.
The world is keen to eradicate malaria completely, and control measures are being substantially scaled up. And part of this whole movement to eradicate malaria includes the increased use of a particular therapy, which is called artemisinin combination therapy. And this is known to be the most effective treatment of malaria. The problem that the world is facing is that the sole source of artemisinin is a medicinal plant, Artemisia annua. It's found wild in China, and in fact, many of the leaves for the preparation of artemisinin are actually collected from wild plants still in China. Elsewhere in the world, it's grown by thousands upon thousands of small-scale farmers throughout Africa, India, China as well, and also Vietnam and many other countries, in fact, in the developing world.
So there's potentially a supply problem.
There is. Very little plant breeding has been carried out on this wild medicinal plant.
How much artemisinin can one get from one plant then?
Well, a typical yield is thought to be about 0.4 to 0.6% of the dry weight of the plant. Obviously, the amount that you get from a plant depends on the biomass, the extent of the leaves of the plant. But in total, it's thought that these days you need to really plant about 20,000 hectares of artemisia.
So obviously one solution would be to find a way to either bulk up the production by growing more plants or to do something to the plants so that they're a lot more effective at producing the agent or it's produced in a form which is easier to extract from the plants.
That's right. The difficulty with growing more artemisia is that it's not a robust crop. The lack of breeding of artemisia has led to really the lack of a robust crop. And even when one is planting large acreages, many of those plants fail. And so the difficulty is that there's never a consistent amount of artemisinin on the market to actually ensure a robust supply for ACTs. There is getting to be, certainly in this year, 2010-2011, an increasing shortage of the actual amount of artemisinin that actually exists and available. But in addition, ACTs are expensive compared to other treatments, even though artemisinin is the only compound currently that is effective against all forms of the parasite that causes the disease.
So what can we do about it?
Well, I think there's two issues. One is that there is a massive new funding or financing mechanism to make ACTs cheaper, and this reduces the ACT price. It's called AMFM, and the AMFM initiative reduces ACT price to equivalent to monotherapies or other substandard drugs. The aim is to increase, therefore, the ACT availability, and therefore more artemisinin will be required, and therefore we have a window of opportunity from the funding to actually get more artemisinin and ACTs into the market, and we have to therefore improve the quality of the plant to be a crop, i.e. to increase the amount of artemisinin that each plant produces, to improve the extraction techniques to ensure that we can increase the efficiency of those, and also to develop new plant varieties that have both increased yield of artemisinin and also are robust in the different growing regions of the world where farmers are growing them.
Do we know how artemisinin plants actually produce the agent?
We have a lot of information about that, and certainly the funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the project that I co-direct with Professor Ian Graham here at York. What we have really managed to do over the last 4 years is gain a huge amount of data, both at the genetic level and at the molecular level and at the chemical level of these plants. We know that artemisinin is made in secretory glands that exist on the surface of the plant, on the aerial parts of the plant, on the leaves mainly. And these secretory glands are like microfactories. They're called trichomes, and they're found on all plants. and they are specialized microfactories for many compounds, particularly terpenoids. And in fact, they play a major role in producing compounds for the entire flavor and fragrance industries.
So does this mean that we could copy them and put them in a plant that is a bit more robust? Or one further step down the line, can we just take the genes that are orchestrating the synthetic process and put them into something which is a lot more cooperative, yeasts or bacteria or something?
That's also a very interesting comment, because the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are funding two strategies, really, to make sure that the artemisinin supply is improved. One is our project, which looks at plants and is the only source of artemisinin currently. And before they funded our project, they actually also funded a team in the States to do exactly as you say, which is to lift the genetic machinery out of the plant and put it into a fermenter and start industrial fermentation. This project is also ongoing and has been taken up currently by Sanofi. But I think one of the important things for everyone to remember is that really the amount of artemisinin that's required, if the AMFM initiative is to work and we're to eradicate malaria, will require multiple approaches to producing artemisinin. And in terms of the plant, it's been calculated by many, many different groups that at least 60 to 70% of the artemisinin required for the next 10 years will have to come from plants, whether or not the industrial fermentation route is successful.
Diana Bowles. She's a biochemist at the University of York. In just a moment, we'll hear how chemists have come up with a clever way to obtain uranium from seawater, and that's not just off the Sellafield coast either. But first, Phil, talking of things that glow, you've been taking a look at some new screen technology.
OK, so this is a sort of electronic paper technology that has very high contrast, very fast switching and very sharp images that don't blur and drift when you try and change them very quickly.
What you're saying is this is a step forward or a step beyond what present e-readers, Kindle, Amazon Reader, that kind of thing, can offer.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. So the current electronic ink technologies rely on sort of balls of fluid that have a black side and a white side, and when you charge them one way, or when you flip the charge, they switch over and you get a switch from black to white. That's not particularly quick, and you don't get a very sharp image, and you don't get very high contrast. So what these guys, led by Yasuke Yamauchi from the National Institute for Material Science in Ibaraki in Japan, have done is take a very white substance, titanium dioxide, to give you a very white base layer, or base level, which they've made into a porous structure, and then inside that a leuco dye, which when you take electrons away from it goes from colourless to black. So you get a very fast switch from the white background of the titanium dioxide to a black ink.
So just to sort of set the scene a bit, what we've got is this titanium dioxide layer which has been made porous, so it's almost like a potato waffle. There's holes, and those holes have had added to them the leuco dye, and you apply a charge to that dye to flip the colour of the dye, and it's either colourless or it's coloured, and therefore the titanium dioxide either goes white or black accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely right. And the really crucial thing about this structure is the fact that the holes, they're vertical holes, but the holes actually confine the dye. So rather than being able to drift around across the surface, they're stuck in these holes. So you can scan the image very quickly, so you can have images that change very fast, but you don't get any blurring out.
And that presumably has all these benefits of low latency and all that kind of thing. Is this in production, or is this just something which is a proof of concept and now it's a question of actually making it work so that people could have this in their pocket?
This is very much at the academic stage. It's quite a new idea for the architecture of building up these kind of e-paper devices. Now that they've sorted the idea, they can look at converting that into a production process. The current process that they're using probably isn't particularly suitable for massive scale-up, but there's all sorts of different... Someone should be able to develop one pretty soon, hopefully.
One thing I can see as being a slight problem is that the technique you've described is monochrome. You've got black or white. Can it do colour?
Well, the group in Japan say, yes, it can do colour. The problem is that you then have to have various different layers of materials that, or different dyes that do the different colours. One way of getting around that to make it much cheaper to manufacture is to use coloured filters to provide the colour, and then just you black them or white them out, depending on where you want the colour.
Well, one thing that's certainly coloured is uranium salts. Bibian, you've got a clever way to get more uranium so that Australia will no longer be able to sell their corner of the market.
Yes, we're all obviously very aware of the rapid depletion of fossil fuels. So scientists are looking at alternative ways of producing energy. And of course, one of them is nuclear fission. Therefore, this makes uranium, which is the main fuel used in nuclear reactors, a very important target for isolation.
Uranium is found in very few places on Earth. Australia is lucky to have very big natural deposits of it. Where else could we get it then?
We can get it from seawater, actually. Uranium has traditionally been extracted from solid ores, such as uraninite, but it can also be extracted from seawater. We have about 4.5 billion tons of uranium in dissolved in our oceans.
Very dispersed, though. Not much of it if you took a gallon of seawater there. So how can you possibly concentrate it in an energy-efficient way?
So what these researchers at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla have done is they have developed a new way of encapsulating it, in extracting it from solution.
So how does it work?
The uranyl ion has got a very distinctive shape. It is quite big and planar. So that makes conventional chelating ligands quite difficult to use. So sequestration so far had been quite challenging. But this group of researchers have discovered that uranyl ions bind very well with carboxylates. So they have used 3-bidentate 2,6-terphenyl carboxylic acid ligands to coordinate the ion, which actually is encased in a nonpolar environment formed by the bulky phenyl groups, which actually stops the ion interacting with the water and is stabilized in that cage.
So those molecules then form effectively a little molecular box with the uranyl ion trapped inside. How do you then get that away from the environment in which it trapped the iron? How do you concentrate those little boxes? Can you filter them out, or do you then grab the boxes chemically somehow?
Well, because they are nonpolar, we can assume that they will be in a different phase from the water, and they will probably float to the top, which then you can skim and then extract using liquid extraction methods.
So this could be a way, basically, of increasing the amount of uranium we have available for various uses.
Absolutely. It would be a fantastic method if it worked. The problem that these researchers have at the moment is that the selectivity is not good enough. And that is the challenge for them in the future. They're working at developing similar chelating ligands that have higher affinity for uranium. And that's where they're going to be working on.
And we wish them luck. Thank you, Bibi. Right. Well, talking of uranium, time now to radiate some humour. Phil.
Well, we're stepping up this month. We've got a joke from John Edwards in London, who said, "How much does a molecule of adenosine triphosphate cost?"
I'd say it's probably 20p less than a pound.
Indeed, it's 80p.
Yeah, not bad. I do want one. I've got a joke for you.
Yeah.
What cheese would you use to tempt a bear out of a tree?
No, I'm lost on that one, Chris.
Camembert, of course.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Well, OK, if you think you can do better than that...
Which, quite frankly, is not hard, is it?
And want to be in with the chance of winning a fabled Chemistry World goodie bag, then send your jokes to chemistryworld@rsc.org. And don't forget to include your address so that we know where to send the goodie bag.
And sincere apologies for the appalling quality of my joke. The email address to send in your complaints and perhaps some superior jokes is chemistryworld@rsc.org. We're back with more chemical shenanigans next month, but don't forget there's also our sister podcast, Chemistry in Its Element, that should keep you entertained in the meantime. Contributors this month were Phil Broadwith, Mike Brown and Bibiana Campaseo. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.